Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing alternative points of view into challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host again for this edition. This week, a coalition of organizations concerned with healthcare and reproductive rights submitted petition signatures to the Secretary of State to place a measure on the November ballot that would amend the state's constitution to safeguard reproductive rights against infringement by any future state laws. This would include the right to contraception as well as the right to abortion in most circumstances. Anti-abortion activists have managed to restrict abortion rights in Ohio ever since the Roe v. Wade decision, which equated abortion issues with privacy, effectively declaring abortion a private medical matter to be decided by a woman and her health care provider without any intervention from the state. But abortion opponents chipped away at it anyway, and by altering definitions of abortion and limiting who could perform the procedure and under what circumstances, where it could be done, and how late during a pregnancy could an abortion be performed. Many of their arguments hinged on the question of whether or when a fetus could be considered viable outside the womb, while ideological opponents posited that to terminate a pregnancy at any stage is to take a life, equating abortion with murder, and even going so far as to claim that all life begins at conception. Abortion rights have narrowed nationally, and especially in states with Republican-majority legislatures. A recent near-total ban in Ohio, adopted by the Republican majority here and signed by the governor, was thrown out by a federal district court. But in other states, abortion rights are severely curtailed after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the Roe v. Wade precedent. With the Supreme Court evidently hostile to women's equality, reproductive rights advocates had to turn to the voters in each state to pass state laws or constitutional amendments to assure the full range of reproductive medical services, including abortion, remain available. This week, petitioners concluded their epic statewide campaign, turning in over 710,000 signatures from all of Ohio's 88 counties, nearly 300,000 more than the state-required threshold. If certified, as expected, Ohioans will have the chance to vote on that issue in November. But there is a potential snag, and that is Issue 1, which will be voted on in a special election on August 8th. Issue 1, proposed by Republican state lawmakers, would severely impede citizens' ability to amend the Constitution in the future. If Issue 1 passes, it may be necessary for reproductive rights advocates to collect even more signatures in a very short amount of time. I attended the press conference on Wednesday where all of this was discussed.
Heartbeat ban, the 6-week ban, went into effect in Ohio, which criminalized our practice of medicine, being able to care for our patients, and people of Ohio were not able to get the care that they needed. And within days, with just a couple days, doctors from around the state started talking to each other about the terrible things that they were hearing and seeing in their clinics and hospitals and emergency rooms. Just horrible stories. Women with cancer who had to delay the initiation of chemotherapy until they could leave the state to have abortion care. The 10-year-old girl who was raped and impregnated and had to leave the state to go to Indiana to have an abortion there. Mothers asking me as a general pediatrician if we should put their young daughters, 12, 13 years old, on birth control to protect them in case they were raped. And the trauma, psychological and physical, of being forced to carry non-viable pregnancies to term against that person's will. These were horror stories that we could not let continue. And so we very quickly came together and learned through our conversations with a diverse group of experts that the best way in Ohio to protect our patients' rights would be to spearhead a citizen-initiated ballot measure to protect reproductive freedom. And that restore and protect the rights that we had had through Roe for almost 50 years. And so we embarked on this huge task. Many people told us that it would be impossible because it seemed impossible to many, but we knew that this is what the people of Ohio wanted, as has been shown over and over again, and we were determined. And so we are all here today thanks to the incredible efforts of so many people, leaders of organizations, grassroots volunteers, doctors. We are here to unite in our shared goal that we're protecting our patients' access to abortion care and everything related to reproductive health care. And so in addition to focusing on our goal of making sure that our patients can have the care that they need when they need it, we often said to ourselves the famous words of Margaret Mead, who said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed individuals can change the world. And that is what we are hoping to do, change the world for the better, as our wonderful and amazing coalition here, Ohioans United for Reproductive Rights, we are hoping to do that one state at a time. Thank you,
everybody. Good morning. Thank you. I'm Amy Fogle, the Ohio Deputy Program Director for Red, White, and Blue. But today, I am a mom, I'm a nurse, I'm a cancer survivor, but most importantly, I'm an Ohioan. The first thing I want to express is how much of an absolute honor it is to be in the company of these outstanding organizations, leaders, volunteers, activists, and passionate Ohioans. Red, White, and Blue is a community of everyday suburban women who are working to encourage their friends and family to get involved politically, often for the very first time. We are 500,000 strong across America, and we are fighting the growing extremist threats against our public education, our reproductive freedom, and democracy. When the Supreme Court's reversal of Roe was first leaked, there was an outpouring of stories from our community. Diverse suburban women with different political backgrounds shared deeply personal experiences about abortion, miscarriage, IVF, and so much more. And they were terrified. We were terrified for ourselves, our daughters, for each other. They were terrified of losing their fundamental rights and their freedoms. At Red, White, and Blue, we knew that we had to do everything we could to protect reproductive freedom here in Ohio. And that's why we have been so grateful to be a part of this amazing coalition. At Red, White, and Blue, our small team trained just over 1,100 everyday Ohioans to collect signatures and staff over 700 events across Ohio. Most were women who had never been involved in politics or engaged in democracy like this. Many had never signed a petition, much like myself. Yet, like they, so many throughout this coalition found themselves in the midst of stressful, everyday busy lives and dedicated hours upon hours volunteering at events and talking to everyone they knew about an issue that so many of us for too long had been told to be quiet about. Whether in suburbs, exurbs, rural areas, women, men, Ohioans are now talking to their friends and neighbors about reproductive freedom, and we're not stopping. For me, one of the most inspiring were those in areas where volunteers and Ohioans feel isolated. But defying expectations, like one day when we collected over 200 signatures in the afternoon at the Strawberry Festival in Miami County, And the best part is that every volunteer left feeling energized, supported, and empowered. I will forever be in awe of the volunteers who attended countless events, collected many hundreds of signatures. But just as memorable for me is the volunteer who handed in her petitions, and she said, "There are only 21 signatures, but they're mine. And these are my friends who would have never otherwise signed the petition." Relational organizing and tapping into our personal networks means that we connected with Ohioans who might not have normally gone out and sought to sign this petition, which leads me to know two things for certain. We talked to thousands of Ohioans who typically do not consider themselves political, but care deeply about abortion rights and reproductive freedom, and know that their rights in Ohio are on the line. This issue transcends partisan politics. Men and women from across the political spectrum, from the far left to the far right, and everything in between have signed this petition. After all these months, time and effort, people are tired and have sacrificed time away from their friends, spouses, and children. And we say thank you to every volunteer and leader here in this coalition because they deserve our gratitude. This sacrifice is a worthy cause, and I know that history will look back on this monumental effort and know that one thing is clear. Everyday citizens put us on the path to enshrine reproductive rights for Ohioans in 2023. Thank you.
Dr. Marcella Azevedo, and I'm one of the co-founders and the president of the Ohio Physicians for Reproductive Rights and Protections Ohio. One year ago, we were in a dark place, in a dark time. It was disturbing for my colleagues, for my patients. We were appalled by the awful decisions we had to make, and by the positions people around us were in, constantly, and every day. From that day, doctors across the state united because we knew we had to create change. And we knew we were surrounded by people who wanted to see that change happen. That's why today I'm full of hope, full of joy. I'm ecstatic. There are 422 boxes with 700,000 signatures. They're everyone. They live in communities large and small, in the big three C's and in Holmes County. They are independents, they're Republicans, they're Democrats. They are people of faith, race, and all sorts of genders. They are everyone. They are all united by the belief that Ohioans need self-sovereignty, that Ohioans need their rights to control their own bodies and to control their medical care. Almost all have access to legal, equitable, comprehensive reproductive medical care, which includes abortion that is free from government interference. Ultimately, this is about giving my patients, our friends, and our families their power back. Over the past year, grassroots organizations, faith groups, and communities from all over the place joined us to make this a reality. So I want to emphasize that this effort is fueled by the hands of Ohioans themselves. We trained 3,000 to 4,000 volunteers who were every day knocking on doors. We're collecting these signatures. We are joined by 4,000 other healthcare members, professionals who are taking care of these patients on a daily basis. We are joined by major established medical organizations that are hundreds of years old and have not participated much in politics previously. We are joined by the Ohio section of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. We are joined by the Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine. We are joined by the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, amongst many others. This is us, but this is everyone else here. Their support to the most trained demonstrates that this is both a sound, a medically based amendment. On behalf of Medical PRR, and I know my partners at the Ohio United for Reproductive Rights. I want to thank you. I want to thank our partner organizations. I want to thank every single Ohioan who did so much to make today possible. But I gotta remind you that we still have work to do. See you there.
Hi, I am Kelly Copeland. I use she, her pronouns, and I am the treasurer of the Ohioans for Reproductive Freedom and executive director of Pro-Choice Ohio. What a difference a year makes. This time last year, abortion funds and abortion clinics were working to get patients to care in other states. They were providing logistical and financial support and love and care. Doctors were referring their patients to clinics that they could get to. But even with that incredible net of harm reduction, we know that some people were forced to continue pregnancies against their will. For 82 days last year, Ohioans suffered under the tyranny of the state legislature and their gerrymandered majorities, their false majorities, and their extremist and corrupt agenda. Today, we say, never again, not under our watch, not for us, not for our children, not for our families, not for our patients. Those 42 boxes are filled with hope and love and dreams of freedom, of bodily autonomy, of health, of being able to say, we decide what happens to us. Not some politician, not some judge, not someone who doesn't know me, who doesn't know my kid, who doesn't know my best friend, but me. We trust Ohioans to make their own reproductive health care decisions, whether it's infertility treatment, contraception, abortion, whatever it is. We know that Ohioans know what's best for them and their families, and we are standing up for that with over 700,000 signatures that agree with us today. In August, and can we pass this amendment in November? Let me tell you something. This coalition has been up against the full force of the corrupt government in Columbus for a decade, and we still have abortion access in every corner of the state. Country, and that will not be the future of my girls or your children. We will see to that on August 8th and November 7th. Yeah! And now we'll take your questions about how we're going to win this thing. Signatures, official.
How many more signatures are you over the threshold to meet the requirement?
The threshold is 413,000 and some change, so well over.
If issue one had passed prior to this election cycle, thus limiting citizens' future access to putting initiatives on the ballot, would your present efforts have met the threshold under issue one?
It's obvious that issue one was put on the ballot to preempt Ohio voters from being able to vote on reproductive freedom and on abortion access. They chose 60% on purpose, and they are making it much harder by forcing all 88 counties to meet the threshold. They did this on purpose, yes, to block abortion access, but also to block democracy, to block one person, one vote. And any issue that is working with all of their members and all of their supporters to be able to take important democratic issues to the ballot will be blocked if issue one passes. So we are part of a mighty coalition that is going to ensure that Ohio voters do come out and vote no in August. And we will win in August, and we will win in November.
Yeah!
Individual freedom and their right to make their reproductive health care decisions. This is for all of us, and it is absolutely what Ohioans want to vote yes on in November.
Were you concerned that that would make it more difficult to pass? Or do you agree with that?
We're really confident in the language that we have put together. It is going to set legal precedent that is going to ensure that all individuals have the ability to make their individual right around reproductive freedom. Our process has been incredible. We have internal backstops. We're really confident in the signatures that we're putting forward. It is hard to collect signatures, but so many Ohioans wanted to sign this petition, and so many volunteers worked incredibly hard. We're really confident in our process that we'll be over the threshold. Of course, but right now this is about our collective power, the 700,000 signatures from all Ohioans, from every county in the state. This is about our victory today.
It seems like both sides so far are trying to paint the other as extreme. And what is claimed about this issue is that if you look at the language, past court decisions, the precedent, that in actuality, despite the overt language, this would allow abortion in some cases, perhaps, until almost the day of birth. Yeah. How would you respond?
What's really exciting about this ballot initiative is that in November, Ohioans are going to be able to make this decision for themselves. We trust Ohioans to be able to make their decision about their reproductive health care, and we know that they are going to come out and vote yes in November.
Would abortion be a possibility as of this issue?
All due respect, that's BS. That's the kind of thing that our opponents say to try to change the subject. There are very few instances where a patient requires an abortion later in pregnancy. And when they do, that is a deeply personal decision with very complex factors that have to be taken into account, ones that no politician or judge should be involved in. I will also say, for people who have questions about the false narratives that our opponents are spewing, read the language. It's clear. It's concise. It talks about when abortion would be available. It talks about infertility treatment. It talks about contraception. It talks about miscarriage management. And what it says, very simply, is that we trust Ohioans to make their own reproductive health care decisions, not politicians. Period. We are blessed to have an incredible coalition working on both issues. And the fundamental issue on both issues is who has a say. When we're talking about issue one in August, it's about Will there be one person, one vote? Will Ohioans have the opportunity, as they have for the last 100 years, to go to the ballot and say, this is what I believe. This is what I think. The politicians who put that forward, they did that because they want to sit in their manufactured majorities through gerrymandering and ignoring court decisions, ignoring the state constitution as it's already written. And now they're trying to sneak an election in August when people are on vacation, when they're getting ready for school, when you're not used to voting. And they're doing that on purpose because they know that their agenda is not the agenda of Ohioans.
If issue one does pass in August, would that have a retroactive impact on your present efforts?
No. The only thing it would impact would be the threshold. It wouldn't impact our ability to get on the ballot because we are filing before that goes into effect. What it would do is it would say that after 100 years of majority rule, that they're going to change that to say that Ohioans can't amend our constitution with 50% plus one of the vote. They're going to say it has to be 60%. And if that's what happens, which I don't believe it will, because I don't think Ohioans are really keen to give up their rights as citizens, we'll meet that threshold. Jesus never shamed women. I believe that Jesus can send those who did. I see Christ in the clinic escorts and workers who stand by women who other people may have turned their back on. And I would say that my faith demands that I do this work, that I stand with people who need a helping hand, who are being stigmatized and just need the love of their community. And I would say, do as your religious says. Love God and love each other. I think that we pass this and we guarantee that any future laws that this legislature would consider will have to adhere to the state constitution.
Would the recent Supreme Court ruling, in effect, partially legalizing discrimination, have an impact on this, your initiative, if it were to pass? Would it perhaps allow physicians to object to providing a service on a religious or conscientious basis?
I am not a constitutional law expert in that area, so I would defer that question to an expert, and we would like to get back to you about that after. Any other questions?
When you talk about future laws that have to be formed, what about retroactive laws?
Well, like the six-week ban, it would be the Constitution that the court would have to judge whether or not the six-week ban violates the Ohio Constitution. And in this case, with this amendment, it would. 20-week ban, maybe as well. The judges will have to determine that.
With the Ohio Supreme Court seemingly having already said how they would vote on abortion rights and how everything happened with redistricting last year, do you think that they're going to listen to this constitutional amendment if it passes?
We were very careful in how we crafted this language so as not to leave loopholes for that kind of political interference from the bench.
Lawmakers
are going to lawmaker, and lawyers are going to take it to court, and this will be the standard by which what they do is judged in the future.
Yeah, I'm just worried about the future. We have over 20 years of various abortion restrictions, the transfer agreements, things like that. I mean, are all those up for grabs, do you think, if this passes in November?
This amendment doesn't automatically overturn any laws in Ohio.
What do you say to the other side who's out there saying that this takes away parental rights to decide abortion, that this would allow abortion right up to the birth, all of this, and they're saying that you're lying? What would you say to that?
Thank you for that question. I wanted to answer that question. You know, a lot of people have talked about the people, the parents who had to take their kids out of state to access care. The people who are interfering with parents being able to get their kids the care they need are the politicians behind the six-week ban in the first place. Why didn't they leave Ohio? It was because of the six-week ban. This would stop that. This does nothing but put the decisions back in the hands of Ohioans. And this amendment would ensure that any state regulation regarding minors has to be about protecting the young person's health and safety. That's what we all want. The reason our opponents want to talk about everything but the central issue is because they know that they're going to lose. They know that they're going to lose if people read the amendment and vote on what it says with their conscience. So of course they want to talk about all kinds of other things. They don't have a leg to stand on. They have had 50 years to make their case, and they have failed. They'll fail in August, and they'll fail in November.
Hi there, and I just have a follow-up to the question about parental consent. As a general pediatrician, I deal with parental consent every day that I'm at work, and the Reproductive Freedom Amendment will not impact any laws relating to parental consent. Everything that's going around in those commercials are overt lies.
I think someone who's sworn to uphold the Constitution of the people should be a little bit more concerned about the will of the people, who are the power behind the Constitution.
How can people donate?
People can currently donate by going to Ohioansforreproductivefreedom.org and pro-choice Ohio, protectchoiceohio.com.
Again, that special election scheduled in violation, I might add, of the rules recently adopted by the legislature will be on August 8th. The only issue on the ballot is Issue 1, which again would significantly raise the number of signatures required to place a proposal on the ballot to amend the state's constitution, and would require a quota of signatures from each of Ohio's 88 counties, as well as 60% voter majority for passage. It's kind of like a legislative poll tax followed by a filibuster, in my view. But if Ohioans turn out and defeat Issue 1 on August 8th, then the Reproductive Rights Amendment proposal can proceed unhindered to the November ballot, where an Ohio majority of voters can decide the issue normally. Last week, I focused on the uranium enrichment plant in Piketon, Ohio, which the Department of Energy is proposing to restart in order to provide fissionable materials for a proposed but largely untested generation of small nuclear reactors. We heard from an Arizona professor who conducted an intensive multi-year study and found escaped uranium and other radioactive isotopes in dust that settled in people's homes and businesses and schools as far away as 14 miles from the now partially decommissioned plant. Next week, we'll hear an epidemiological study and more testimony from the hearing held last month in Piketon. But this half of today's show, I wanted to present a personal hero of mine, a woman who worked in the Piketon plant and who developed a range of life-threatening health ailments as a result of her industrial exposures. She became one of the first whistleblowers, a genuine Karen Silkwood or Aaron Brockovich from our state. I first met her at another hearing at the Piketon plant more than a decade ago, and her health at that time was very tenuous, but she spoke passionately. Frankly, I was surprised and delighted to see her again in this most recent hearing. She still suffers from ill health due to radiation and chemical exposure she endured in the plant, but she's still wholly dedicated to the struggle to get it shut down and cleaned up. Her name is Vina Colley, and I had a chance to speak with her after the hearing. So, Vina Colley, you worked at the same plant that we've been discussing here in this hearing today some time ago, and you noticed hazardous working conditions and other safety policy violations and became kind of a whistleblower. Can you just recount a little bit about what happened to you, what brought you to that point?
Well, I started in 1980. And I kind of started breaking out in rashes in by 1983. And some of the workers I was working with, they were breaking out in rashes. And so one worker mentioned to me, probably it might be, first I thought it was a trichloroethylene and a PCB oil. Well, later on I found out the PCB oil was contaminated with radiation. And so I decided to write a letter to the Department of Labor that I felt more than 25 workers or 30 were being exposed to radiation. So that's how I got started in. And, of course, once I used a red phone at the plant because they said if you have an oil leak, call this number. Well, I made a mistake because when I found with the Department of Labor, they found out that something was going on that I knew but I didn't know. So I got sick. And my doctor said it was the chemicals and stuff I was working in. So I went off work probably a year or so because I was really sick. And I, all of a sudden, they come over to my house and they were interrogating me for like 8 hours. And they kept asking me the same questions over and over and over. And I thought, what do I know that I don't know? And they was asking me about the PCB oil and the trichloroethylene. Well, at that time, I didn't know that the PCB oil was radioactive oil, and we were cleaning transformers. I was an electrician, so we were doing electrical work, and we were cleaning these transformers that had PCB oil on it. Well, I found a document, a 1985 document with Senator Glenn asking these contractors if that was just regular oil or did it have radiation characteristics. Well, after I did all this investigation, I found out that we were cleaning uranium-contaminated PCB oil with trichloroethylene that were radioactive. The process buildings that they processed this reactor fuel with was leaking into the buildings onto the floors that we were walking. One document I saw, they had like 290-some thousand parts per million up in the ventilated system, and when it came down and hit the floor, I don't know what the readings were. And once it hits the floor, it hits another chemical. Well, I started digging out, trying to find out really what was going on with me, because my hair was falling out, and I had 3 tumors and a total hysterectomy. And I was a perfect, healthy person. I mean, they took all these tests on me to make sure I didn't have any illnesses. And then they even sent me back to my doctor because they wanted more tests because they couldn't believe I was that healthy. But they like healthy workers because it takes a healthy worker longer to get sick. So after they lied to me, then I knew something else was going on. So I just kept digging, and I found these old documents, like they had PCB, or they had off-site contamination. And I went to the EPA office, and I found the documents that the government documents that they knew that there was off-site contamination coming from Piketon, going into big Little Beaver and Big Beaver Creek. And that creek empties out into the Scioto River, which empties out into the Ohio River. So then I got the EPA involved, and we all went down to this. There's a pipe, a direct pipe, that goes from the plant to the Scioto River. And they came in and went down with me, and they were testing the fish, and they were testing the Scioto River. The fish were radioactive, and they had hexavalent chromium that was coming from the cooling towers. And so one thing led to another. We started taking soil samples of the community and their wells. And once up in the EPA office, I found out that Dorothy Dunham's well was contaminated with TCE.
And what is that?
That's the technetium. And they had a cistern, so I guess the fallout from the plant was going into their cistern, into their gutters and down into the cistern. And so the next time I went to the EPA office, they said, we want you to call us and tell us what you want, because our attorneys have to look at the documents. But it was too late, because I already found the EPA discussing with the company about these creeks being contaminated. And so just one thing led to another. And then I went to a public meeting once and started talking about, I read in the paper that they were talking about PCB oil and the trichloroethylene. So when I went to the community meeting, I think it was about 1987, 88, and before I left that meeting, they decided they wanted to make me president of their group. So I'm president of the Portsmouth-Piketon Residents for Environmental Safety and Security. We co-chaired National Nuclear Workers for Justice. We were the first group that started the National Nuclear Workers, and we started the first memorial. Well, Cold War patriots come around, and they took our work and went to Washington, D.C., and they got the memorial changed to, I think it was October 29th or something. And so they never did give National Nuclear Workers for Justice the credit that they deserved for that. And I started gathering documents from courthouses in the basement, workers, testimonies from people. I testified on human experimentation because I felt the workers at Piketon were being exposed and they were being experimented on. And then I went to Washington, D.C., and I gave a testimony on the workers and the testimony on the X705, and the X705 was reprocessing, they were doing experimental work on plutonium. And then the big secret is what we were supposed to be doing. We were in a uranium enrichment facility. We were supposed to be enriching the uranium for weapons, submarines, and it highly assayed, the highest you could get, 97%. Well, what they were doing since 1955, they were shipping in reactor fuel from West Valley, New York, and the workers up there thought they were working in a uranium plant and they were working in a plutonium extraction plant. They sent their stuff to Piketon, and when they did that, it gummed up Piketon. Transuranics went everywhere. You can't get rid of it. And so they continue till 92, sending reactor fuel to Piketon. And then in 92, they signed an agreement with Russia. And so we started getting Russia's stuff that had technetium and plutonium and americium. And I think what really got the community involved at that time was the school over here, Zions Middle School. There was like 5 or 6, maybe even 11 kids I heard tonight that were dying of cancer. And they have a direct pipe that goes from the plant to the Scioto River. That pipe empties out into the Ohio River about 15 miles down the road. And then I read years ago, a couple of press members, that Zions Middle School, according to their environmental report, was contaminated. But
and that's on that river route?
Yeah, but they never paid any attention to our press members who found that. And we also did a cancer study with Dr. Velma Shear, and the cancer was going up from 1950 to 1980. And not only the cancer, but the heart rate was going up too.
The rate of heart disease?
Yes. So the heart and cancer has risen since 1955. Then I found a document on the workers. The state of Ohio knew in 1957 that they had 5 workers, 4 years after production, was in the hospital dying of cancers. One of them's named Nathan Salyers, and I have a newspaper article on him. So then I started gathering newspaper articles, starting to read what was going on here. And through some of my documents, I found out that they buried that whole nickel plant from Huntington, West Virginia. And so I gave that story to a guy named Jim Ross in Huntington Herald, and he published that story about the nickel plant. It was buried out here when our workers were on strike. And at the same time, our workers were going to Washington, D.C. with the leadership of Danny Bloomfield. And they were lobbying over the health and safety issues and went into Storm Senator Glenn's office. And they promised these workers that we would get a full investigation. But all we got was harassment. The workers got harassment. They went after the president of the union. And everything's gone. And then an investigating team come in after I complained so much and find all these documents. They came in and started, in 92 I asked the company, do you have plutonium, at a public meeting, and it's in a deposition. They said no. So in 99, when I started reading the documents finally, I found out that we had plutonium. So my friend Mary Bird Davis, who was working with me, she was from Uranium Wise. She got a phone call from one of the reporters down in Kentucky, and she said, we're getting ready to break the story about Paducah. And that she said, well, what do you have on Paducah? And he said, we've got plutonium here. 3 workers or 4 workers filed a lawsuit, and someone leaked it to the media. And I had worked with those 2 reporters for some time, Jim Carroll and I can't think of the other one's name. And then she said, well, with Vina's documents, we have plutonium. Marvin Rezikoff came in with Mary Bird Davis, and we found out that 360 acres on that site had plutonium in it. And I think it's the same 368 acres where they put the 12 waste cells. We fought the waste cells. There's so much here that has went on through the years. I can't remember everything that we've done. I mean, we have broke almost every major story out here. Yeah.
So the plant has been continuing to operate in some capacity. What is it that they're doing right now?
Right now they're in a massive cleanup, and they tear down these buildings that's got plutonium and neptunium in it because they're not admitting that they have it. So they're tearing it down. They're using water spray to keep the dust down some. And I was just told the other day that there's some workers working on the south end of the plant, and they're digging up these barrels. And these workers are young workers, and they're standing around where it's at, and they're sprinkling down some of the dust with water, and they're not suited up with anything.
So the plant is only in a deconstruction phase right now? It's not actually producing anything?
They're decommissioning, but they're getting ready. They just announced that they want to put 2 power plants out here. And they're getting ready in the GSET project to basically do what they did over in the GSET project. They want to do it in the centrifuge now. and they're calling it a high-assay, low-enriched uranium. And what they want to do, in my opinion that they were reprocessing since 55 until they stopped the production. And so I was right on that. And some people call it recycling or reprocessing or whatever, but they were sending their junk here, and we were reprocessing it, and it contaminated our site and gummed it up from West Valley, New York, Savannah River, Hanford, and all these other sites. And so now they're starting up the centrifuge, and they're going to take and bring everyone's transuranics back here to reprocess it for small modular reactors. So they're doing the same thing, except on a smaller scale. Before, they were feeding large reactors and the nuclear navy and all that, and now they want to reprocess again and make it for small modular reactors.
And is this because they're wanting to build new reactors and replace coal plants with nuclear plants?
Yes. Yeah, they want to build some small reactors, and they want to process the stuff here and send it there. And another, we have a community group called Southern Ohio Port Authority and SODI, Southern Ohio Diversity or something. I can't think the name of them. But they've been filtering that money through them without any public input. Nobody knows where this money's going in Scioto County. And they're filtering this through SODI, and they're giving them money to rebuild them a new school here. Why is Portsmouth and SODI involved in building them a new school here? It doesn't make sense to me, other than they're filtering the money. I know they've had a lot of money come from President Biden, and they're not telling people where that money comes from. Everything's closed door, and now somebody let me know, said, well, you know, SODI is going to be the one that got filtered the money for Zion's Corner. So that tells me where the money's going to in Portsmouth, like for the homeless and for the rehabs and all this stuff here.
So earlier,
there's a lot of criminals in this community and Portsmouth.
Earlier you said that the Ohio EPA, who you had asked to investigate some of the instances of illegal discharge or pollution that you had found, had you gave them information, they did investigations, and yet they were speaking with company officials, and essentially nothing was done then,
no,
right?
Officials
so you're saying that the EPA was sort of in collusion with the company?
I think the EPA doesn't do their own testing. They take split samples, but what they get is the paperwork. They don't get the actual dirt and water, they get the actual papers. And who knows where the plant's getting the soil or whatever, you know, to give to the EPA.
So you're saying the EPA relies on self-reporting from the companies?
Right. They do. The company gives them their information. They're actually, I think Ketter told me there is a lab, but it's somewhere down south somewhere, that the EPA does their own sampling. But that the EPA needs to do their own sampling, because these people are liars. It's in their own documents. Someone needs to go to jail. If we could ever prosecute one contractor like they did with the workers, then I think they'd all be jumping out and wanting to either tell the truth or get out of Piketon.
Is there a government agency in the chain of command among the regulatory agencies or investigative agencies that you do have confidence in?
No, none of them. They all lie. The company lies, the DOE lies, the contractors lie. No.
So what is the solution ultimately? Because the plant does or will employ a significant number of people in Piketon, is a significant source of revenue. We've heard people here who've worked at the plant as you did, who described horror stories, and yet who say they want to see it cleaned up and operating safely. Is that a possibility? And what would Piketon do without the plant?
Our government owes us jobs. They owe us clean, safe jobs. Why can't they put a car factory or something close to here, or Amazon or something? We don't want any more nuclear stuff in here. Sodai is being given contaminated land out there. I mean, we got contamination 14 miles, and this group is going to take and put, they want to put two more power plants out here. Now, I don't know who they're going to feed unless it's for the centrifuge. I don't know. I don't know why they want to put two more power plants out here. Or maybe it's just a way to filter some grant money so they can all keep their money in their pockets. I don't understand it. And when they have a meeting, my group has been here since 89. We are never invited to give our input. We even broke the bedrock fractures. The bedrock is fractured under this site. And when they come here, they go on site. They hold their own little political meetings on there. They do not talk to the community. And as you see today, how many were invited here? The seats were empty.
So what would a non-nuclear Piketon Portsmouth look like? What would replace that that revenue?
Hopefully it would look like a healthier community, for one. I mean, they're telling people not to even put a garden out, and these people live off their gardens. I think the DOE don't want to admit that we have plutonium, because as long as they don't admit it, they're not liable. But they know, because they've already admitted. 1999, when we broke the story about the plutonium for the workers, they claimed that we got one diluted cylinder. But they know, because, you know, I've been telling them for years, and they have to know. I mean, if I tell you there's something wrong, I'm going to go investigate. They did have some investigating teams come in here. There's a Volume 1 and Volume 2. And the documents that I had, they told me they'd never seen them before, and they wanted to make copies, and they made copies of them, and they put them in this investigating team. And we doubled the Superfund twice, doubled it. But there was a consent agreement from the state of Ohio, and I think they probably already broke that consent agreement many times, and I don't know why somebody's not out here finding these people.
Lastly, not much was said about the waste products from the plant itself, other than what was ejected into the air or into the river. But there were additional waste products, especially from the cleaning of machines, cleaning of the facility, and that sort of thing. You told me about that about 12 years or so ago, the last time I spoke with you about all of this. What happened to the waste products, especially the liquid waste products?
I think a lot of the PCBOs got shipped off-site. And they didn't tell them that it had transuranics in it. I think they've illegally shipped it places. That's what I think they've done.
And where would that be shipped? Would it go to underground injection wells, like with fracking waste?
It would have to go to a site that takes high-level waste. Piketon is a low-level waste site. We're not supposed to have plutonium, americium, technetium here. We have it here. And some of these representatives need to come out with the company and tell us why it's here and why they haven't told the community. You know, I've told them years ago, we can't rebuild and we can't do anything until we know. I mean, you can't fix something until you know what's wrong. But I think it's so bad now, they'll never be able to fix it.
That was Vina Colley, a former employee at the Piketon Uranium Enrichment Plant. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, now expected to resume broadcasting again on the 98.3 frequency at the end of this month, and on WGRNLP 94.1 FM, which should also be back on the air within the next couple of weeks. I'm Evan Davis, wishing you a good week ahead, and I'll see you all again next week at this time for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM. WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.